acting ahead of a disaster increases the choice set that households have to navigate the shock on their own terms. Providing early warnings to households ahead of flooding can allow for them to prepare for floods, which then reduces the destruction of their assets.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Well, as we record this podcast, in Bangladesh, millions of people are being displaced by flooding. And unfortunately in Bangladesh, this is now a regular occurrence. In the monsoon season of 2020, for instance, 5.5 million people were affected by severe floods. But at that time, the United Nations World Food Programme was able to help 23,000 of those households along the Jamuna River before the floods hit. It sent a cash transfer of just over $50 to help them. Now, how effective are anticipatory cash transfers like this? Ashley Popel of the University of Oxford and Ruth Hill of the World Bank helped evaluate the results of this intervention, and they join me now. Ashley, welcome.
Hi, Tim. Great to be here.
And Ruth, you're welcome as well.
Thank you very much, Tim. Great to be here.
Now, Ashley, this is help in time of need. It's really help before the time of need. Why anticipate like this rather than wait until there is a disaster where you know precisely where to target the help?
Great question, Tim. You're right. There is a bit of a trade-off between acting earlier and targeting accuracy. So the question is, why not wait until you have complete information about who will be most affected, and instead delivering using predictions and forecasts to deliver cash ahead of a flood? So we have a couple of reasons to believe that the marginal impact from acting earlier kind of offsets this cost of targeting either the wrong people, a few wrong people, or excluding a few right people. The first is that acting ahead of a disaster increases the choice set that households have to navigate the shock on their own terms. So there's plenty of evidence that exists already that suggests that providing early warnings to households ahead of flooding can allow for them to prepare for floods, which then reduces the destruction of their assets. And there's some also important operational reasons for acting earlier. It's really difficult to reach people once the disaster has struck. And you could argue that the people who are most affected are the ones who would be least accessible at that point in time. There's really a big question here of whether we can use other proxies that correlate flood impact with targeting so that we can use that to reach the most affected.
We know, Ruth, that Bangladesh has regular floods. It's a low-lying country, and so there is a regular need for this kind of emergency aid. How would it normally be delivered to households?
After a big disaster like a flood, there's usually a process of assessment and identifying need where teams visit the area affected, survey the damage, see how many households are struggling to meet needs, what kind of needs they have, and put together a plan, a sort of a financing plan, what is needed to be able to meet the needs of these households. They will then fundraise against that plan. So the needs we've identified, let's get funding to meet these needs. And then after they've received funds, support will then be delivered to the households that were most identified as being in need. So you can imagine that this normal process actually takes quite a bit of time, even though everybody's doing every stage as quickly as possible. And so in this, just as Ashley was mentioning, in this situation, because floods happen so often, a number of these parts of the process can be estimated in advance, even though you might not know exactly who's going to need support. You can do some of this assessment or identification of what you need in advance to speed up the process.
Yes, tell me a little bit more about that, Ashley. To be able to make an anticipatory payment, you must be able to anticipate who is going to be affected by the shock. So going back to 2020, how did the United Nations World Food Programme know who would be affected in Bangladesh?
At that stage, I would say the data that was being used was more to identify when to act as opposed to who to target. It was the very first pilot of its nature. And so at that point, the UN were, because of COVID and having the floods came a lot sooner, were using pre-existing lists to be able to identify who to target. Subsequently, in the third iteration of this pilot, the UN have now joined forces across all the different agencies to try identify ahead of time who would be most impacted and do collective targeting. So it's been a really good example of how pilots have subsequently fed into improved quality of programming. The UN has worked really hard in trying to use data to automate the decision of when to act. And here they've really worked with local flood experts to global and national flood forecasts and a model that has been well calibrated to the basin of interest, which then deliver fairly good predictions up to 2 weeks ahead of the flood. And so the idea is if an extreme flood is being predicted, then there's these two-stage triggers. And the first trigger, a readiness trigger, which can activate up to 10 days before the flood peak, tells us, okay, now's the time to prepare for the upcoming floods. And that's when the UN agencies start to identify and verify who should be targeted at that point in time. So it's really not a big window before the flood peak actually arrives. So that scope for error of exclusion is actually fairly small. Then when the second trigger is activated, and this is usually 5 days before the flood peak, that's when the interventions and support are delivered ahead of the flood peak.
Ruth, to do an evaluation of how much these anticipatory transfers can help in this case, I guess you must have a set of households in your survey that didn't receive these payments but were affected by the floods. Who were they and why didn't they get the anticipatory payment?
So we had households in our survey who were equally impacted by the flood.
Mm-hmm.
They were equally vulnerable as well based on this vulnerability score that was done in advance of the flood. And crucially, they also, so the way the transfer was delivered was by mobile money. So these were also households that had mobile money accounts and used mobile money. But the key difference in this case was that they did not have an account with the mobile money provider that was used to make the transfer. So on all these other criteria, they were the same, but they just had a different phone contract.
Mm-hmm.
They just had a different company. And actually, that was sort of, in a way, an accident of the fact that this was implemented so quickly. You know, if it had been implemented with more time, no doubt WFP would have been using multiple providers. But this was done quickly and there was one provider being used.
I see. And Ashley, tell me about the evaluation here. So how long did you wait after the disaster to measure the difference in outcomes between houses that received the payments and those that didn't?
So we conducted our follow-up survey about 3 months after the flood event, which is actually quite a long time.
Yes.
Given that these interventions, you know, the cash was really only intended to help households to minimize the negative effects of the flood on food security and asset destruction. Despite that, we do see statistically significant effects on a wide range of outcomes, including food consumption, well-being, even recovery, despite being quite a few months later.
How big are these differences?
We observe statistically strong treatment effects across a wide range of outcomes, as I mentioned. But to be fair, these effect sizes are relatively small, at least smaller than what the World Food Programme were hoping for. So for instance, children in treated households were 3 percentage points more likely to consume 3 or more meals a day prior to the survey. So this effect isn't enormous, although it is robust across a wide range of different outcomes, in part because we had a sample size of 9,000 households.
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, I think the types of effects we see and we measure suggest that the cash could mitigate potentially long-term scarring on household welfare. So it's well known that even short-term disruptions in child nutritional intake could have negative effects on longer-term educational and, say, earnings outcomes, for example, in the future. So although small but significant, and also striking that we measure them before a traditional response or more reactive humanitarian response would have even been delivered. There's all these negative effects that would have existed prior to that time.
Do we know why these better outcomes occurred? Is it because the households, when they get the anticipatory payment, are able to prepare for the impact of the flood? Or is it that they then have that money available so that they can recover from the flood more quickly afterwards?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And, you know, as Ashley mentioned, we tried as much as possible to understand, you know, on how many dimensions did this money have an impact and, you know, why. What we were able to see is that households that received the transfer, they did protect their consumption much better at the time of the flood. They were also more likely to evacuate. They were more likely to move their livestock.
Mm-hmm.
So these things do sort of point to there being a reduced impact of the flood at the time of the flood. But we do also see evidence that there was maybe less use of what we would call costly coping mechanisms, so sort of taking a high interest loan to deal with the cost of the flood. We do see some evidence of that. It is possible that the money was used to actually help recovery, replacing things that were lost. But at the same time, it was a pretty small amount of money given. So we think that's probably less likely than the other options. What we're able to do in the paper is show some of these differences, even though we can't definitively answer exactly why that was. There were these differences.
Given that, does that mean that there is an optimum time at which to deliver this assistance? Too far beforehand, and it's difficult to target it, I guess. Too close to the event, people are unable to make any of these preparatory changes in their behaviour. Do we know when the best time is?
We don't. So I think that's sort of like a really great question for further work on this. So I think
yes.
we were wondering even whether maybe it wasn't enough time in advance of the floods that some of these households were receiving the transfer. I think what we're able to show in this paper is that there is an impact at the moment that can be alleviated, and that if we use the usual model, isn't alleviated. But in terms of refining how we actually do that, I think these are great questions for further work.
Yes, because this is a new type of intervention, isn't it? And as you say, it's being refined as we go along. But considering that extreme climate events are overwhelmingly likely to become more frequent, especially in regions like Bangladesh and northern India, do we yet have enough evidence to encourage more interventions like this and make them a standard part of disaster response? And I guess as well, we can't anticipate every type of natural disaster. So, you know, how many disasters could we be able to even do this for?
So my answer is yes, I think the portfolio of evidence is growing and there's enough preliminary evidence to suggest that this should be part of the toolkit for disaster response. It is more effective, impactful, and also a faster form of delivering even the financing. So having pre-agreed financing is a quicker way to get the typical humanitarian funds out there at a faster rate. Although, you know, lots to be learned still about when, how, who do we target? And so these are all many open questions for further discussion. In terms of the number of disasters that we can do this for, a much-cited ODI study finds that up to 20% of crises are predictable, so potentially could be suitable for anticipatory action. Though I should note that the study is currently being revised, so we'll know more soon. The UN ACHA, who is leading on some of these pilots, have found that it's actually quite tricky to predict certain types of disasters, especially those relating to conflict. It's clear that this approach is better suited for certain types of disasters like floods, especially conditional on there being good data, but maybe not other types of crises.
I think there's a lot of disasters that are predictable every year. You know, think drought in the Sahel, drought in the Horn of Africa, as we have now, floods in Bangladesh, floods in other parts of the world, extreme heats in cities in South Asia. So there's a lot of things that are predictable. And when you've got something like a flood, the needs are very immediate. And actions that households can take at the time of the flood that will reduce the cost of this event to them. And so the more we can get better at predicting, you know, and this is definitely a field where we're making leaps and bounds in terms of predicting climate events in a very localized scale, and then it's great to get support to these households in advance. But I think it's just still really important lessons for other events. For example, for drought, it's something that builds up slowly over time. Even if you can't anticipate so precisely that the rains will fail exactly at planting time, you still know whether or not the rains have failed in advance of the harvest. And you still have a sense of, you know, what the needs are going to unfold to be, even if it's only going to be some months later. And so I think what this whole approach shows is just the advantage of acting early, even if it's not acting in advance of the climate shock. So being able to do some of the things that were done in this intervention that helped speed things up. So just doing some of that pre-planning before a crisis about what are the likely needs. Doing, as Ashley mentioned, these pre-approvals sounds so simple, but it really makes a difference in terms of speed if some of these things are in place already. Having the systems that can deliver support quickly, having these agreements with mobile money operators, making sure that people have access to mobile money, even the most vulnerable. These are all things that just speed up response. So even if, you know, a household doesn't need it in advance of a crisis, they can get it very quickly once a crisis occurred. And I think actually COVID has taught us so much in this regard, looking at the response to COVID-19. Maybe we could have predicted it, but we didn't. And so there was, you know, a lot of needs that were felt very, very quickly by a lot of households, especially poor households in the informal sector as they stopped working. And we've learned a lot about what helped governments deliver support to them quickly. And so there's no need to not implement those lessons now. You know, we've learned about the importance of knowing who poor people are and how to reach them, how to provide transport to them. We learned the importance of having finance available to do that and not be scrambling around to try and work out how to finance some of these needs only after they occur. Even if we're not anticipating every disaster, I think there's huge lessons from this work for just acting faster when disasters occur.
I remember speaking to your co-author, Stefan Durkon, a couple of years ago on Vox Dev Talks, and this was something that he was very strongly advocating at that time. So it's very interesting to see ideas like this being put into practice. It's equally fascinating to find out what you're learning as you go along from them. So I'll be looking forward to your further work on that. But meanwhile, thank you very much, Ashley.
Thanks, Tim.
And Ruth as well.
Thank you so much, Tim. Great speaking with you.
The paper that covers this is called Anticipatory Cash Transfers in Climate Disaster Response, and the authors are Ashley Popel, Ruth Hill, Stefan Durkon, and Ben Brunkhorst. This has been a Vox Dev Talk, and the best way to make sure you don't miss any of our episodes is to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be there. And our past episodes are always at voxdev.org, where you will also find articles about the papers we feature.